Hi, and welcome to Power of 10, a podcast about design operating at many levels, zooming out from thoughtful detail through to organisational transformation and onto changes in society and the world. My name's Andy Pollane. I'm a service design and innovation consultant, coach, trainer, and writer. My guest today is Alla Weinberg, the CEO of Spoken Wheel, a learning, leadership, and people development company. She is a workplace relationship expert, helping companies build loving leaders, trusting teams, and cultures of safety through training, coaching, and facilitation. And she's also written a book all about that called A Culture of Safety, Building an Environment for People to Think, Collaborate, and Innovate, published by Sense and Respond Press. Alla, welcome to Power of 10.
Thank you for having me, Andy. Happy to be here.
So what got you into this line of work and made you decide this book was needed?
It actually came from my own personal experiences at work. I was a designer for close to 15 years, working in various roles, starting as an information architect back when that was the title, focusing later in my career in research, and then eventually teaching design and design thinking. And in the majority, I'm not going to say all, but in the majority of my work environments, I felt unsafe. I didn't feel internally relaxed at work. I was worried about what I could say, what I should say, to whom, when, and if I say something, will my job, I know, be in danger in some respect, and then therefore my livelihood and ability to take care of my basic needs. I certainly never felt safe to talk about my emotions at work because that's not professional. That's not considered professional. And right before I wrote the book, I had an especially, I would say, traumatic experience with that at work, and decided I really want to talk about this topic because I want workplaces to change. I want to see a shift in how people relate to each other at work.
So clearly this conversation is still necessary, but why? Why is it that we're still talking about this, or, you know, only just beginning to in some cases? Why is work so broken?
I think it's just, and I write about this in the book, I think it's a held over entrenched beliefs back from the industrial era. So just as the industrial era was burgeoning, there was this thought that Frederick Taylor had, which was specifically, and it was called Taylorism now, which he went around and did talks. He spoke around the country about this, which is how to create more efficiency on the assembly line. And in his view, the way that you create more efficiency is by having managers that think and workers that execute. The workers don't think, they just execute. And that set of beliefs that Frederick Taylor had and that set of principles still carries on to this day, got very much entrenched in how people think about work. And now we just don't question it anymore. We just assume, yeah, that's how we work together. But honestly, it was a guy's idea. It was one guy's idea. It caught on, it got very popular, but it just has taken hold and hasn't been questioned, I think, for a long time. And I'm here to question it. And I was like, I don't think it has to be this way.
I was reading, is it Jamie McCallum's book, Worked Over? And there's a whole bit in that where he dives into it and, you know, talks about how much Taylor actually fudged his data.
Absolutely.
And so it's all kind of based on some pretty sort of shonky data. So listen, in the book, you also talk about different kinds of safety. So I thought it may be quite good to sort of unpack those to start with. Why don't you also sort of talk about the nature of fear too? And that's perhaps a good place to start, because I guess safety is fear is an absence of safety. Right? And then we could maybe kind of unpack each type of safety, and then, you know, we'll go from there.
That sounds great.
So do you want to start with, you know, the three kinds of safety?
Yes. So when I was starting to write the book, I thought there were only two kinds of safety, which is emotional safety, so being able to express how we're feeling, and psychological safety, which many people know about, which is feeling safe to express our ideas. But as I was writing it, I learned from a biological standpoint that there's a third type of safety, which is physical safety, and that's feeling safe and relaxed in our bodies physically. And this is intimately tied to our biology. So our entire body and neurobiology, our brain, the way that it works, and our nervous system, the entire time that we're alive, is constantly checking for if we're safe from danger to our physical body. And the way that it does that is through a process called neuroception, which is our nervous system, through our five senses, is able to pick up signals and send signals of danger to our brain. And that's the first thing that our brain checks for. Is my body physically safe? Unfortunately, our brain cannot tell the difference between a lion trying to eat us and an angry stakeholder that we're working with.
It feels the same.
It feels completely, to the brain and to the nervous system, it feels exactly the same. It's your physical body, your life is in danger. And our entire system is organized to keep us alive, to keep us safe. So if that's the case, what happens is we're going to get flooded with a bunch of different hormones. We're going to go into fight, flight, or freeze mode. And we're not going to be able to think because the blood that normally rushes to the part of our brain, which is the frontal cortex, the front part of the brain where your forehead is, the blood will rush out of that part where we actually have the ability to think, and it will redistribute to let us, you know, run, to put, you know, blood and resources into other areas to keep us safe. So if we do not feel physically safe because our bodies look different, have different abilities, or a different gender, or just a minority in a group, our nervous system is going to start to send signals, you're not physically safe, and we're not going to be able to think. So that's the first sort of check that your body does. And then secondly, after that, if let's say your body does feel safe, okay, great. You know, you are feeling relaxed in a group, for example, of people. The second thing your body, your brain is going to check for is, am I emotionally safe? Can I connect with these people and not be hurt emotionally? Because there's physical hurt, there's physical pain, there's also emotional pain. And so at work, when we're not allowed to really, it's not okay to express our emotions, we have to suppress it, that sends a signal to our brain that we're not safe. And again, same thing happens. Blood rushes away from the part of the brain that can think and it prepares to protect ourselves. So this is still a protection mechanism that's happening. And only after we feel physically safe, emotionally safe, can we feel psychologically safe, which is it okay to share ideas by idea or disagree with the boss, you know, or say, hey, I'm concerned that this is going in the wrong direction, kind of raise a flag. Only then will we be able to address psychological safety and having the ability to feel relaxed enough to share your thoughts. So those are the three different types of safety.
Right. It's interesting, you know, when I coach and, you know, quite often that expression comes up of I was in this meeting or I was asked this question and I felt like a rabbit in the headlights, you know, or a deer in the headlights. And I felt like I couldn't think at that moment.
Freeze.
Freeze, right? And so, and it's where you felt like a deer in the headlights because that's exactly what you were at that moment.
That's
in time.
Exactly the same
reaction. Yeah.
I actually had that experience last week. I was at a meeting.
And sorry, I don't know why I'm laughing. That seems a bit mean.
I'm glad
you can laugh about it.
But there was an individual that was aggressive towards me and I got flooded. This is what happens to us in our nervous system. I got overwhelmed. And so I froze and blanked out and didn't know how to respond. An hour later, once I was able to calm down, I was like, oh, I wish I would have said X, Y, and Z, but I didn't at that time.
I mean, I think everyone's had that experience of the brilliant riposte that comes half an hour too late.
Yes.
So, you know, we have it all the time, and I've seen it, you see it in all sorts of different areas. I want to go back to this idea of being professional that you mentioned before, because I feel like there's a lot of horrors kind of wrapped up in that expression of you need to be more professional. What's your reading of that phrase and of, you know, what does it mean to be professional?
My reading of that is that it's almost meaning you need to be more mechanical. So that means more productive, less emotional, much more task and tactical oriented, producing more and more output over time. That's the kind of, again, holdover from that industrial age of this is what it really means to be a professional, is you're almost acting like a machine versus a human being.
And yet the word, you know, the professions were non, you know, working class professions, right? The professions were to be a doctor or a lawyer and so forth, which were much more, well, should be much more human things. I mean, I have a whole kind of bugbear with the way medicine is taught, because it feels like that's become very kind of mechanical as well. And in fact, there's this weird arc that, so there's a complete sidetrack from design, but there's this weird arc that kind of medical professionals seem to go through where start off getting into medicine because of a very human desire, have that completely sort of stripped out of them when they're studying, and then sort of beaten out of them in very, very hierarchical environments as they kind of rise up. And the sort of humanity bit only comes back in once they become at the very top again as kind of a specialist. Often they become, I think it's a confidence thing, actually. I had this very conversation with a coachee today about, you know, the more confident you are, the more you're able to be yourself. And of course, the more you're able to be yourself, the more confident you are, and that kind of cycle. Which I can see how, you know, that what you're describing in your book really, you know, talks to that. I've got a question, which is the, you know, the question from the business side of things. Because I can imagine there's a conversation that you probably have had plenty of times that goes somewhere along the lines of, well, that's all very nice, making people feel kind of happy and safe at work. But, you know, how does that help us? How does it help us as a business? Why should we bother?
I do get that question a lot. So the way I talk to business about it is that safety and trust and all the things that I talk about, even loving leadership, which is something I teach, is the means to get businesses what they want in the end. What they want a lot of times is, I often hear this a lot, is velocity. They want their teams to be able to work faster. You can't do that without trust, because you're not going to speak to the person if you don't trust them. You're not going to work well with a person you don't trust. You're not going to share information with a person you don't trust. There is velocity. Yeah. Now that goes down. I also talk often with people, they want innovation. They want creativity. Well, people need to be able to think in order to get that. And in order to be able to think and have full access to their intelligence, then they need to feel safe. They need to feel trust in their team. And then this is a biological fact, right? So I often talk about that safety is the means to the ends that businesses are looking for and wanting.
There does seem to be a kind of paradox in that, I mean, all of this is kind of based in fear, right? All of this is really sort of steeped in fear. But there's the paradox being that the fear that a project is going to go off the rails or isn't going to go fast enough, and I hear velocity a lot too, and I kind of hate it, as if kind of speed is somehow automatically better.
Better, yeah.
But the fear that a project is going to go too slow, go off the rails or whatever, creates behaviors, mostly in leaders or leadership, that actually make it go off the rails, in that they grip tighter.
Yes.
You know, one of the ways I've described it is if you imagine being you're skydiving, right? And you're doing a tandem skydive, and you're afraid of that you're afraid you're going to splat on the ground. And so you grip the instructor's hands really tightly because you're so afraid. And of course, then he can't pull the chute, you know, because there's no space. I was quite surprised by one thing, which is this, that first of all, you talked about, you know, ways to build safety. Mm-hmm. Right? And I wondered if, you know, enable safety. I wonder if you have a differentiation between kind of enabling safety versus sort of building safety for starters. Maybe I'll start with that question. Is there a difference, or am I just using different words?
I don't think, in my mind, I don't feel like there's a difference. Safety isn't something that you can make happen. It's something that emerges from the environment and the interactions that people have with each other. So as a leader, I can't go around and be like, now you're safe, and then act that way. You know, that doesn't work.
But that happens though, right? I mean, that's the same as that sort of culture thing of like, here, everyone can say anything they want. Okay, have you got that? Everyone can say anything they want.
Go, say it. Yeah.
Yes.
No thanks.
I have actually heard an anecdote from a friend of mine. He used to be in management consulting. Now he does kind of similar thing to me. And his boss came and said, right, we're going to brainstorm different ways we can, you know, do stuff. And he made a suggestion. And it was actually about reducing their margins, because he said, you know, our clients just think we basically, our margins are too high. And his boss turned to him. That was the first suggestion, right? His boss said, well, I can tell you all, we're not going to do that. Right. Any other suggestions? And it was like a scene from The Office.
No, I'm good.
So, but I thought it was interesting. I mean, there was a crucial point. So you can't just kind of give someone safe, nor or sort of make someone directly safe, that it's in emergence between the relationships between people. And the bit that I was surprised about, though, was how you suggested meetings were a good place to start.
Yeah.
So maybe you could take away my surprise there and tell
me
why meetings.
I'm curious what was surprised. So surprising.
Just because I, because meetings have a lot of problems too.
Yeah.
I guess is where I'm going. But.
Yes. Meetings do have a lot of problems. And the reason I suggested meetings was because that is the place where people come together and they relate to each other in a specific way. And that's where a lot of the cultural norms, which are, again, the ways people relate to each other, are present, are surfaced, are available. And so from why I suggest changing meetings is it's something operationally that people can do immediately, that they can actually affect change on. Even if you're just an IC, you can still create a meeting, right? You don't have to be a leader to do that. Although, of course, I want leadership to model and show the way. And it's almost a sandbox for me of practicing different ways to relate to each other, because a lot of what I suggest for safety and the way people need to talk to each other, what they talk about, how they talk about it, is very unfamiliar because we don't have that in our workplace. And we need a sandbox to practice it and to mess up and to get better with each other. And through the messing up and cleaning up the messes, that's how safety gets built. Oh, I can say the wrong thing and it's okay. And I'm still supported and I'm helped by my team, by my group. Now I'm like, huh, okay, I feel a little better. I feel a little safer. It starts to build then.
You mentioned people, particularly minorities in the workplace, having to work sort of twice as hard. And you mentioned code switching and this, you know, people of, I was going to say people of color, but it's also kind of other minorities too. Anything that's outside, I guess, what is the established, you know, norm is of which in workplace, which is, you know, tends to be people who look like me, kind of middle-aged white men. You know, maybe can you talk about what code switching is and the kind of cognitive overhead of that in terms of safety?
Mm-hmm. Code switching is, in some respect, mirroring the dominant culture in the way that your talk, in the cadence of your speech, in how you present things, and it's not necessarily maybe your most authentic way of speaking, of being, of presenting yourself. And so you're, as a person that would do that, and even as a female, I have seen other females do code switching when they're in an executive suite, speaking more aggressively, more like their male counterparts, right? Yeah. And so I, let's say a woman in that kind of environment, have to then put on a performance. I have to put on a show to try to match what I'm seeing, rather than just being relaxed and being myself and speaking in the way I would normally speak and phrasing things or presenting things in a way that feel more natural and authentic to me specifically. And so that takes a lot of more, like that takes emotional work to do and cognitive work to do as well, on top of the other work that I'm doing.
Right. And so that's an overhead on top of anything else. So it doesn't take much to kind of then push you into a kind of moment of freeze, right?
Yes.
And whereas someone like me, who looks like me, would, I don't have to think about that because the established norm is people who are looking and speaking and being like me.
Yeah.
So, you know, Sense and Respond are well known for the books that they produce are very practical. And there's a lot of practical tips and practices, actually, in your book. Maybe could you share some? What do you think are some of the kind of most essential? You've talked about sort of changing meetings, but there's quite a lot of other practical things in there that people can do.
I think the most essential, especially for team leaders at any level, so you can be a leader of ICs or other managers or of the whole organization. So for team leaders, because again of how we're biologically wired, for team leaders to be able to regulate their nervous system and to feel more calm and centered themselves, so that when they're coming to their team and they're talking to their team, what happens is that people will be able to co-regulate with that leader, meaning, oh, the leader's feeling calm, feeling centered, feeling okay. My nervous system will take that as a sign that I'm safe, I'm okay, everything's okay. And for leaders to do that, I do have a little exercise in there about a body scan. So really just checking in with your body. What that does, from a neurological standpoint, is it tells your nervous system and your brain that I am safe. Because I'm putting my attention on the sensations in my body, and sensations being like, oh, I feel a tightness in my stomach, I feel some heaviness in my chest, I notice I'm clenching my jaw, my brow is furrowed, it feels kind of tight in there. Just noticing your body, your physical body, sends a signal to your body and to your brain that you're safe and that you're okay. And so even just that small practice, a couple minutes of a leader before going into a meeting, doing a body scan, noticing the sensations that you're feeling, coming into that meeting much more centered, much more calm, will help everyone else pick up on that signal and also feel safer and calmer and be able to think in that meeting.
Right, because that was the thing I was getting to, is what can you do for everyone else, or what can everyone, you know, mm-hmm. how can you make it safe for everyone else? So the fact that you're coming in with that energy, I'm going to say, it's going to sound a little bit kind of hand wavy, I know, to some people, but, you know, with that energy, transmits it to kind of everyone else and sends the signal to everyone else that, you know, this is okay.
It's just, we have to understand our biology, and we're such social creatures. This is how we're wired. If we regulate ourselves, we also co-regulate with others. And this makes sense because for a long time in our human history, we lived in tribes, and their job was to protect us from lions or from other hostile tribes and keep us alive. And so if somebody else in the tribe is feeling calm, like everything's okay, and that gets sent around to everybody else, and everybody's like, okay, we're not under attack, everything's fine, I can relax, I can feel safe. And that's still true for us.
Yeah. And yet so much language, I mean, talked about velocity, but so much language is about kind of speed. Well, why do we, why speed? Oh, because in one sense or another, bad things are going to happen if we don't go fast enough. Yes. We're going to run out of money. Our competition's going to take over. There's always this kind of push. And again, it's become a very dominant management practice to push in that way of kind of creating fear. I mean, FOMO is still fear, right? The fear of missing out is still a fear. Like, you know, all the food will be gone by the time we get to the watering hole.
And this is also a practice I write about in the book, which is a fear inventory. And I think that's also very, very important for anyone at work. I do this every day. This is part of my practice, is to start to be honest with yourself about the fears you have, maybe around a certain project, maybe around your team, anything work-related that you want. And I suggest just a stream of consciousness, write it down. I have a fear that this project is going to fail. I have a fear that this project is going to take too long. I have a fear that this project is going to cost too much. I have a fear that we're going to spend all this time and it's going to be a flop. You know, get all those fears out so that the fears are no longer driving your actions and your decisions, because that's the driver right now in most companies and organizations.
I think also sharing them, you know, there's an activity I do as a territory map. It's basically a kind of affinity cluster map, actually, at the beginning of projects quite often. But also, you know, when I was consulting as the kind of activity to try and work out what's the problem space, which is, and I get people to map across or think about their loves, hates, hopes, and fears. And, you know, loves and hates tends to give you the sort of present and past. Like, these are things I've enjoyed or really irritate me. But hopes and fears were always interesting because they kind of give you the dreams and also obviously the fears and worries. You know, and there'd often be things like, I hope this isn't going to be another project where we do a load of kind of stuff and, up front and nothing ever happens.
Yes.
But the act of doing that collectively, people do it individually first and then you kind of do a post-up. Collectively was very useful because you get this shared sense of, the shared sense of fear actually was very useful because people don't feel alone. And the more you do it, the more people feel like they can they can share.
Yeah.
And be sort of honest. Which brings me to a bit where you said about, you know, emotions, bringing your emotions to work, or bringing, allowing for emotions to be, all emotions to be mm-hmm. heard. And you said, you know, when you talk about this, you get pushback from leadership, you know, saying, well, you surely not any emotion. What about rage or lust? And yet.
And yet.
You do. Yes.
And yet it's, and even just what you spoke about, being able to have the safety to share any emotion creates connection between two people. Because sharing an emotion is actually a very vulnerable act to do. And it's in a way revealing something that's happening for you individually to another person. And it's vulnerable because you're taking a risk in sharing that, and you're exposing yourself, which is the definition of vulnerability, risk, exposure, or it's risk or or emotional exposure, right? And so, or uncertainty. I was trying to remember the the definition. Uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure. That's the definition of vulnerability. And so you're being vulnerable with another individual. And when we do that, we're saying to the person, I want to be closer to you. I want to connect with you. And so for both people to be able to know how to receive somebody else's emotion, a lot of times people will be like, oh, I need to fix it now. You don't need to fix it, right? Or I need to solve this. I need to fix it. You don't. But knowing how to receive that, and knowing that that's what the person is doing, is being vulnerable, not and asking. It's a bid for connection. It's asking for a connection. And just holding that, hearing them, and receiving that with kindness, not dismissal, not fixing, creates that connection. And so there is some skill, honestly, that we're missing in the workplace about first how to express all of those emotions in a healthy way, and then also how to receive it if somebody's expressing it to you as well.
Yeah. I feel like the latter of those is the tougher one or it's the more unpracticed or the least practiced skill. Because the other side can be dressed up in kind of, well, I just tell it how it is, you know, mm-hmm. I just say it how it is, you know, and I just see it, you know, tell it like I see it or whatever it is. And I'm just direct and I'm, you know, even aggressive, you know, I'm aggressively truthful about this, that and the other, right? Well, often it's also actually not expressing emotions, and certainly not vulnerably. It's often actually just kind of being aggressive. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you talk about having a venting session mm-hmm. as a practical thing. Now, I've seen those. There's a method called Stinky Fish that I think comes from Hyper Island, or I've seen it kind of elsewhere. People can Google that one. But the idea being that if you have a stinky fish, the more longer you carry it with you, the more it stinks. And so mm-hmm. There's this method where you kind of put the stinky fish on the table and talk about it. I've facilitated mm-hmm. badly, it seems, the one that really turned into a venting session. And, you know, we had to have lunch. We had to have a break to kind of just reset. So how do you prevent a venting session from just becoming, because they can become really toxic, right?
I think the structure of that session is very, very important. Whenever you're having a conversation about emotions specifically, having a good, strong structure of how you're going to talk about it is super, super important. That helps create a container so it doesn't all sort of go off chaotically and off the rails in a lot of ways. And so for a venting session, I recommend what's called a circle process, which is allowing everyone to talk and vent and say what they need to say in turn, one at a time, and there's no crosstalk about it. I don't need to, as another individual in the group, question your feelings. You are feeling what you're feeling. Feelings are unarguable. This is how you're feeling at this moment. And it's so important, again, as a group, to validate, yes, you are feeling this right now. It's okay that you're feeling this right now. And it is real that you're feeling this right now. And I don't have to make a comment about that. And so just letting everyone kind of have a couple rounds, maybe a couple questions that people answer, like, what are you most frustrated about right now? What hasn't been said that needs to be said? What are you feeling in this moment? Couple rounds. Everyone takes a turn. There's no crosstalk. You just let people speak and let others witness and listen as people are speaking.
So I want to kind of, not push back, but I want to kind of give you an example, which I'm sure you also know, and wonder how you kind of think about this and deal with it, which is, it's possible for the expression of feelings to become a passive or just literally aggressive act, in the sense that, a team can end up being completely revolving around sort of pacifying or someone else's feelings. And in that, you know, it can drift into a cultural thing where it's like everyone's feelings are kind of equally important, and everyone, and, you know, in one sense they are, but on the other sense, that doesn't mean to say everyone has to then kowtow to everyone's kind of feelings. So I guess you would sort of call it that sort of entitlement culture, but that's not quite what I'm saying. Do you know what I mean by that sort of situation where it can kind of drift into a sort of stasis because no one wants to kind of ride over anyone's feelings or hurt anyone's feelings, and it can be used and abused as in, well, I don't really feel this, I don't really want that, and so nothing happens.
I feel like you mentioned two different things, so I'm trying.
I probably did. I think I did.
I'm trying to unpack it a little bit. One is maybe if folks are aggressively or really stuck in a blame sort of attitude, it's somebody else's fault, and that's how I'm feeling, and I have strong feelings against someone, and I'm blaming them. And another one is maybe when they're not feeling safe to share their true feelings and emotions. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think so. I think one of it's also about using that. We're all about a culture of safety here, so you have to do what I want, is I guess what I'm kind of getting at. You know, if it can be, that can be used against kind of a group to sort of control a group. So, you know, that's why I meant it's kind of like a passive-aggressive kind of thing, really.
Yeah. This goes to conflict specifically then, right? And that I don't write about this directly in my book, but it's something I've been thinking about in my work a great deal, which is how do we create spaces for people to have productive conflict? It's not productive to say, well, I feel the strongest about this, so you have to do what I say. But productive conflict is taking time to deeply understand each other's feelings and how we arrived at those feelings, our life experiences, our thought processes of how we arrived at those feelings. And then finding a third way. So that means not the way you want to do it and not the way I want to do it, but a completely, this is where creativity can come in, a completely third way of doing something that's different, that's novel, but that has both of our needs be met. And what often happens in groups and in feeling sessions is people will relate to each other in, I need to get my needs met, even if that means you lose.
I have
to get my needs met. And the shift in mindset, and I say this directly to groups, how can we get all of our needs met? Let's get creative. People don't have conflict around needs. Everybody can understand and empathize that you have your certain needs and I have my certain needs. There's never any conflict about that. The conflict is always about the strategies we use to meet those needs. And especially if I'm feeling very strongly about something, I'm going to want you to use my strategy to meet my needs. And the key here is, how can we find a strategy where all, a completely different new strategy where all of our needs can be met?
So a fellow podcaster and friend of mine, John Curran, who's a business anthropologist, he talks about, he specializes actually in about talking about conflict or conflict in the workplace, and not like people fighting, but this, you know, he's in the UK, he's British too, but which maybe says something about it, which is that, you know, in general, there's a lot of conflict avoidance. So a lot of the kind of politics and behind the scenes stuff and all those things are actually to kind of avoid out and out conflict or open conflict, but actually that conflict is in fact a good thing. And particularly amongst creative teams, that your team's trying to be creative, I say, not sort of necessarily creative teams, because it's a symptom of something, right? It's showing you that there are different ways of looking at this thing. It's showing you that there are different ways of thinking about, you know, this structure, this organization, ways of working, all of those kinds of things. And actually that to avoid conflict, and if you've ever been in a very conflict avoidance culture, everything sort of drifts towards a kind of mediocre middle.
And so does the work. That's the thing.
Yeah, exactly.
So does the work. The quality of the work sort of drifts to this mediocre middle. And everybody knows it. And if you ask anybody, how do you feel about the quality of the work? They're going to go, meh. It's okay.
Yeah. And I always have to think of the, you know, famously Fleetwood Mac's Rumours album, you know, where they're all like just, having affairs with each other and it's complete, this kind of crazy thing where they kind of all hate each other. And yet, you know, they somehow managed to create this amazing sort of legendary album. Mm-hmm. And it seems to happen a lot, actually, in music. I think it happens probably, you know, a lot with bands. It seems to happen a reasonable amount in sort of theatre and acting mm-hmm. and film and so forth, where it's... somehow it's more allowable, or I don't know if it's because you've got this third medium of the mm. music and or the kind of characters you're playing or so forth. I think there's probably also a lot of lack of safety by all accounts. I mean, Me Too, sure. The Me Too movement is obviously, you know, the biggest indicator.
But look how much creativity comes out of that tension. Like yeah. how much really amazing creativity is available. And I look at conflict not as necessarily that we're in a fight with each other, but that yeah. something new is trying to happen, some new information is trying to be seen, some new understanding is trying to emerge. What is it? Like, and so I question, like, this is a question I put to myself, like, what is it that's trying to emerge here? What new thing is wanting to get created? It's really a creative, like, I really look at it, conflict as creative tension. There's something new that's wanting to be created between us. What is it? What is it?
Yeah, I think this is often the misunderstanding between, as I think Lisa Welchman said this to me, you know, or Teresa Neal, one of them said, you're saying I'm not being collaborative when actually what you're saying is I'm not being cooperative. Mm-hmm. But collaboration is really about exploring that third space.
Yes.
So we're coming up to time. As you know, The Power of Ten is named after this Rand Charles Eames film. And the last question is always, what one small thing, and it may be something that's kind of overlooked and undervalued, if it was redesigned or kind of rethought, would have an outsized impact on the world?
I think if we rethought, of course, everything I think about is work-related. So if we rethought organizations away from the paradigm of a machine towards a paradigm of what Martin Luther King called a beloved community, I think that would fundamentally change how we think, be, work with each other. And we spend 90,000, the average person spends 90,000 hours of their life at work, which is
really?
More than...
That's shocking.
Yeah, I know. Which is more, so we spend more time with the people we work with than the people we chose to be with in our life, our children, our spouses, our partners. We deserve as human beings to work in a beloved community that fulfills and nurtures us and loves us and supports us, not as part of a cog in a larger machine.
Thank you very much. So where can people find you online, on the interwebs?
Yeah, my website is spokeandwheel.co, so that's .co. I'm also on LinkedIn and on Twitter. My handle is IamAlaW.
And we'll put all those in the show notes and a link to the book as well. Thank you so much for being my guest on Power of 10.
Thank you for having me, Andy.
As I'm sure you're aware, you've been listening to Power of 10. My name is Andy Pullane. You can find me at apullane on Twitter, opullane.com, where you can find more episodes and sign up for my newsletter, Doctor's Note. If you like the show, please take a moment to give it a rating on iTunes. It really helps others find us. And as always, get in touch if you have any comments, feedback, or suggestions for guests. All the links are in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.